Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Jennifer Corning, and we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Just southwest of Lovell, Wyoming, off Highway 14, you can walk freely into the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center. Over a span of 3 years, in 1942, nearly 15,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans were confined at Heart Mountain. Today, the Interpretive Center provides an overview of the relocation and incarceration experiences of Japanese Americans. Ora Sunaday Newland is a fourth-generation Wyomingite and fourth-generation Japanese-American, and she's the executive director of the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation. She is expert on the center and the experiences of those internees at Heart Mountain.
Ora, welcome to Resounds, Yellowstone Public Radio's arts and culture program. But we are not in the studio today. We are actually at Heart Mountain, and thank you for hosting us. Could you just begin by telling us the purpose of the Interpretive Center?
Sure. Hi, Corby. Thank you so much for having me on the program. We at the Heart Mountain Wyoming Foundation run a world-class, now Smithsonian affiliate museum here, the Heart Mountain Interpretive Center, along with preserving a wider campus covering our historic site. This is the site where, as you mentioned in the introduction, around 14,000 people of Japanese ancestry were incarcerated during World War II. They were incarcerated here purely on the basis of their race. And now, with this extraordinary museum and facility that we have on site, we are able to kind of reclaim that history and educate the public about it, invite people in for dialogue so that something like this doesn't happen again to another group moving forward.
We were talking earlier about how many interesting places there are in Montana and Wyoming that a lot of people from Montana and Wyoming don't even know about. This is an amazing museum. It's just so comprehensive and interesting, but I'm sure most people would ask, why is it in Wyoming? Tell us about why the camp was set up here.
Heart Mountain was one of 10 main camps established by the War Relocation Authority during World War II to hold Japanese immigrants and their American-born children. It was not all people of Japanese ancestry who were incarcerated in these camps. It was only the people who had been living on the west coast of the United States, so Washington, Oregon, and California. If you lived in those exclusion zones, you were forcibly removed from your home and placed in one of these 10 camps around the country. The camps were all on the interior, and they, you know, there was a political process for selecting the sites, but they were all in remote locations. They all had to have access by rail, and also one of the things the folks were looking for was an area to develop farmland.
It's interesting that you said the people came from primarily Seattle, Oregon, California. And why just those states? And why not, if you were a Japanese American in Chicago, why weren't those people affected?
Well, it's a very good question, and what you've done there is, as soon as you dig just an inch below the surface, the rationale for placing everybody in camps en masse falls apart, really. The U.S. government at the time, the rationale that they provided that was ultimately upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court in one of the decisions that is now viewed as one of the worst decisions in Supreme Court history, the rationale was that Japanese immigrants and their children on the West Coast provided a national security threat. because they were closer to Japan, I guess, or because they were closer to the ocean and there was, you know, fear of radio transmissions. But actually, the FBI and the Department of the Navy at the time had already established that the immigrant community did not pose any kind of national security threat, and in fact had recommended to the executive branch that they not do anything en masse with the immigrant community. And so it actually has been shown that the real reasons established by the United States Congress, you know, with a commission that took place in the 1980s, the real reasons for this mass incarceration of Japanese immigrants and their children were racism, war hysteria, and failed political leadership. So this kind of arbitrariness of only these sections of Washington, Oregon, and California was as arbitrary as anything else.
I find it very interesting, the quote that's on the wall when you first come into the museum addresses something that I think is very important right now about life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, when in fact the people that were sent here were denied those very rights. Can you speak to that?
Sure. These are our Fifth Amendment protections in the U.S. Constitution, and they apply to American citizens, of course. Anyone who is an immigrant to our country doesn't have as many rights as citizens, but, you know, two-thirds of the people who were incarcerated in these camps were American-born citizens. And a lot of folks will say things like, well, when times are strenuous, we have to take extraordinary measures to keep our population safe. And while it was unfortunate, at least people had food to eat, you know, and at least people had a place to go. You know, some people have said, well, Japanese Americans were moved here for their own protection. Again, those reasons fall flat as soon as you look at things like, well, if they were here for their own protection, how come the guns in the guard towers were pointed inward rather than outward? People lost a lot. You know, these were not death camps in Europe like we saw with the Holocaust, but people did lose their freedom. People lost their belongings, their homes, everything they had built for their lives were lost and taken away by the federal government. And I should say, including my family. So my grandmother's family was incarcerated here at Heart Mountain.
It's very interesting to actually see the barracks. And you have a beautiful display that shows what the room looked like when they moved in. Of course, there's no indoor plumbing. There's no water. But then on the other side, it shows what the families did to try to create a home life for themselves, which I find very interesting. But getting back to the fact that these people were moved here, what happened to their homes and their businesses on the coast? Certainly some of these were probably very successful business people. What became of their possessions?
Most families lost everything, and again, I'll go back to your earlier question about why were people removed, especially from the West Coast? They were very successful on the West Coast, and they had inspired jealousy by especially the farming community on the West Coast. And it was because of their success that for a long time, a lot of leaders wanted to get rid of Japanese Americans from the West Coast. So again, that was a thin rationale for bringing them here. While a few families, you know, were lucky and they had friends who looked after their property on the West Coast and were able to reclaim their property when they returned after the war, that was rare. Most people lost everything. So, for example, my relatives had a grocery store in East Hollywood, and they had to sell, you know, their belongings for pennies to the dollar, knowing that they would have to leave. And, you know, there were arrangements to have neighbors or other business partners look after things. But on the whole, most people lost everything. They there was nothing for them to go back to.
I think it's important for people to know when they were moved here, there was not a choice. They actually were prisoners. Prisoners at Heart Mountain. Can you describe what that living condition was for families arriving here? There's beautiful information on all the displays, but since we're on radio, I'm going to ask you to sort of just give a little overview of what it was like when people arrived here.
Life at camp changed a lot from when folks first arrived to when they left at the end of the war. And we hear a lot of talk about the resilience of the Japanese American community, and folks really were incredibly resilient, making the most of a terrible situation. When people arrived, the barracks that they lived in were, you know, rickety, put up, you know, very quickly, no insulation, and that first winter, the temperature got down to about 30 below zero, and these were people who, on the whole, had come from California. They were not used to the harsh winter weather of Wyoming, and conditions were very harsh. Food insecurity was a major concern, and people were in a totally new environment. They were not free to leave. It was very clear that they were prisoners. After a while, people were able to get permission to leave the camp, but still, you can see in the historical records how they had to petition for everything. Every movement they made was documented by the camp administration, and they were definitely not free. Now, throughout the camp years, people did make the most of what they could, and art and culture was a big part of that story of life at camp and how people were able to cope. They turned to hobbies. They created art out of what they could find. They celebrated their Japanese culture in ways that they could, in ways that they were able to hold on to. But instead of seeing that as an indication of just how resilient the Japanese people were and Japanese Americans were, I see that more of a coping strategy. This was how people were able to tend to their, you know, mental health and try to keep things a little bit normal for their children by turning to the arts, by trying to make their barracks seem like a home as much as they could. And now, in hindsight, as we hear narratives about resilience, I'm also always careful to contextualize that and say that resilience was a survival technique, really. The crushing reality of being taken from your home, incarcerated indefinitely, due to no fault of your own. People had to find a way to survive, both physically and psychologically, mentally, emotionally. And so just to look at the resilience piece kind of disregards the trauma. And we try to tell a story of both of those here at our site.
There are so many little details that I love. And the one that I thought was so interesting is these camps were built with really green wood. And as the wood shrunk, it would leave giant holes in between the panels. And not only was that terrible for the cold with no insulation, but the dust storms. They said the first year there was so much dust constantly blowing in through these cracks. It must have been a devastating first couple of years. What you do see when you go through the museum is, I think you're right, it's coping skills. You have lost all dignity. You know, you're a prisoner here, but it is so fascinating to see what they did to survive, to raise their children. Imagine having a child and having to explain to the child. Well, I don't need to be telling you this. You're the director. But I think that is, you make a very good point, is that the resilience is a remarkable story, but it doesn't mask the reality of the situation.
Exactly.
At one point, this was the third largest city in Wyoming, which is so amazing. How was it received by the people in Wyoming?
You know, there were mixed reviews, mixed receptions, and a lot of that, you know, had to do with the press. When they started when word started getting out that they would be building a camp here, I think the alarm was probably the predominant response from local communities because, you know, we're bringing these dangerous people and they have to be locked up for some reason. It must be because they're dangerous. So I think there was a lot of probably fear and suspicion and hostility toward these new prisoners who were coming here on the part of the local community. Although the local newspapers played a role in how incarcerees were viewed also. So both the towns of Cody and Powell are wonderful right now. We have wonderful relationships. But you know what? One of the things that former incarcerees say when they come back here is that we really love the town of Powell and we don't really like Cody that much. And this was because when people were able to leave, when they, you know, got permission to leave partway through their incarceration, you know, they could go into Cody and go shopping or go out to eat theoretically, but they were met with signs in the windows that said, you know, no Japanese allowed, although it used a racial slur. And so there had been, you know, editorials in the newspaper and ways that people talk just making it feel like the town of Cody was a hostile place for incarcerees. Not all of it, but in general. The town of Powell, on the other hand, was viewed as more welcoming, and part of that we've, you know, pointed to the different ways of reporting on the camp, saying that Cody wasn't as welcoming. That's a generalization, but there were certainly individuals and groups in all of our communities that were very welcoming and very compassionate, and the faith community was one of them. So the Episcopal minister in Cody, you know, came out here and brought people out here to provide services and to be welcoming. I had not heard of the LDS Church doing that, but I'm not surprised. There were Methodist groups who brought things out for Christmas and things like that. So certainly there's a lot of beautiful stories to be told, especially from the faith community and how they were able to support incarcerees.
One of the things that's wonderful about this museum is there are so many photographs. So when you say there were places in Cody that were not welcoming, you have the signs in front of the stores. You're not making this up. So there is an incredible history in pictures and photographs. But at the same time, the government was trying to make what was going on here look much nicer than it actually was. There's a display of a local Japanese photographer taking pictures of the life here. And then there was a picture from the government and the way they made people think life was going on here. So it's all told and it's all, you can interpret what went on here by just the artifacts themselves and the photographs.
Yes, and one of the exciting things that we've been able to do is bring in teachers from around the region and also around the country and guide them on how to critically analyze. Like you said, we can put photographs side by side, a government propaganda photo that shows, you know, a very nice kitchen scene with, you know, this happy Japanese-American family living very comfortably at Heart Mountain. But then you put that side by side with other artist renditions, whether it's sketches or photography, that shows the hardships of life here. And that's, you know, a lesson not just for our museum and our history, but in general, we could tell that story. You know, the history that comes out of an image or a document has to be contextualized with who created that image and why, and was there an angle that the artist or the reporter was trying to depict? And it's a kind of a fun and fascinating way to approach history.
That brings me to my next question, Jennifer, and thank you for the details here. But in 1988, President Ronald Reagan signed the Civil Liberties Act, and it acknowledged the injustice of relocation and internment camps for Japanese citizens. Prior to that, I'm wondering about this space. So can you tell us some background about how the site was turned into an interpretive center?
Yes, well, after the war ended, the footprint of the camp disappeared almost immediately. The barracks were sold off for $1 apiece to returning veterans and homesteaders so that they could develop the land and start rebuilding their lives. And for decades, you could drive between Cody and Powell, Wyoming, and see really nothing here. There are very few remnants of the actual camp that are still here. We have an original root cellar. We have some of the hospital buildings and this iconic boiler chimney that was part of the hospital that's still, you know, a landmark that tells you, you know, where the site was. But other than that, it's empty, and it was like that for decades. And it was really the efforts, the joint efforts of former incarcerees who were mostly, you know, living in California, they'd gone back to California at this point, and local homesteaders who had grown up in the barracks, you know, their families in a way had benefited from the housing that was made available. And this group of homesteaders locally said, you know, there's something very important that happened here. We care about it, and it needs to be remembered. It needs to be honored. And so it was a partnership between the local homesteaders and former incarcerees coming together, first, you know, making some plaques, and then we made a memorial walking trail, and eventually we were able to celebrate the grand opening of our museum in 2011. And then just last year, in 2024, we celebrated the grand opening of a new expansion to the museum, which is the Minetta Simpson Institute at Heart Mountain.
So people that visit here need to know that it's not just a historical site and an interpretive center, but there's all kinds of things going on here. It's a very active place. Tell us a little bit about the sort of activities that go on here.
Well, one of, I'm so glad that you asked that question, because I've had people ask me, like, this is such a dark history, and isn't it sad to be working at Heart Mountain, or isn't it sad to be, you know, dwelling on this dark history all the time? And my response is that actually it's quite the opposite. It's very exciting. It's inspiring. It is actually fun because of what we have built here. I think it would be very sad if there was nothing here to commemorate what happened here and the families who lived here. But since we do have this spectacular facility here, it is a place that is filled with hope and joy and pain. But that's what makes us know that we're alive, right? If we can feel both joy and pain and hope and distress. So we try to invite people into that space where they can feel really human. For example, in terms of arts and cultural activities, one of the directions that we started going in the last couple of years is to connect our story of Japanese American incarceration with other intersecting stories. So in one sense, you know, long before my relatives and other people of Japanese ancestry were forcibly moved to this site, our indigenous brothers and sisters were forcibly removed from this same site. Heart Mountain was a sacred mountain and remains a sacred mountain for indigenous peoples, particularly the Absaloka, who are now on the Crow Reservation in Montana. But the landscape is the same, and one of the things that we are now doing at our site is actively telling Absaloka history and Absaloka stories in relation to this mountain and the sacredness of this site. Our historic site caretaker, Johnny Tim Yellowtail, is a member of the Absaloka Nation, and throughout the summer, he'll be giving guided tours of our residential barrack and of our mock-up of a guard tower, where he will relay stories about the Japanese Americans who were incarcerated here, but he also tells part of his own oral history from his family. He's a descendant of Chief Grable, and he's a champion powwow dancer and singer and drummer, and so he'll sing and relay those stories on our site, which to me is incredibly powerful. And again, it's not about dwelling on the horrors of the past. It's about showing a new way forward, how groups coming from all different ages, races, genders, political persuasions can come here and find something invigorating and hopeful. A similar program is that we are, for 2 years, hosting a young woman from Japan through the Japan Outreach Initiative. It's a program of the Japanese government, and their aim is to kind of spread goodwill between our countries at the grassroots level. So our JOI coordinator, she's called J-O-I, is JOI. She's here for 2 years. Her name is Haruka. And she is offering Japanese cultural programs to our local community and also the tourists who come and visit us. And you might say, well, wasn't part of the problem with incarceration that the government and the public couldn't really tell the difference, or were not willing to tell the difference between the immigrant community and Japan? And that's true. We're still trying to teach people that, you know, the Empire of Japan was different than Japanese American realities. But what we're doing with these cultural programs and arts programs focused on Japanese tradition, for me, it's a way of reclaiming what was taken away from our Japanese American community. During the war, we were literally punished and incarcerated for having anything to do with Japan. And so now we're coming full circle by, you know, we really are celebrating Japanese culture here as a way to reclaim what was taken away from us.
Aura, this has been a delightful conversation. We will have more information on our website about Heart Mountain. You know, Yellowstone Public Radio has a huge listening audience, and I encourage anyone that has not been here to visit Heart Mountain. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Corby Skinner, Jennifer Corning, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Nauman. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.